is a castle and I am the sentry, granting the spineless the easiest entry. My simple subjects are eager to bow, so fire up the spit, wheel in the cow. I'm in my element now, toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego again. Their praises, they're nursing me now with their sweet empty phrases. The critics are cleaved from my peace with the mallet. No spoils are received by the king's fragile palate. Stuffing myself on the blind adulation, fed full of self, its intense mastication. The simpleton's choir has taken its place, accolades spewing from each vacant face. Now let's say grace. Toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego again. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego, toasting my virtue. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end.
Feeding My Ego by Stuart Davis. Perhaps the title gives away why I've chosen to mark that piece the anthem of the radio personality, commentator, host, DJ. I think Stu had something slightly different in mind when he wrote it. Hi. This is the Mideast Madness Show, and it's 6 minutes past 1500 hours here. My name is Ren Tawil. I've been doing the show since about the first part of July of last year. And I've come to the realization that the audience, at least for maybe a long time now, will continue to be very, very small. I believe that has a lot more to do with the nature of free radio, pirate radio, underground radio, than it does with the content or the nature of my particular show, Mideast Madness. But I shall persist and continue with my message. For those of you who are taking their maiden voyage on the show with us today, I am a Palestinian American. My father was born and raised in Jerusalem, grew up in Palestine. When he was born in 1915, Palestine was under Turkish or Ottoman Empire occupation. By the time he was 5 years old and the Great War had ended, Palestine fell under the control of Great Britain, the winners of the Great World War I, one of the winners. And, of course, by then, for a number of decades, those of the Jewish faith, some individuals of the Jewish faith, embraced a philosophy called Zionism, which, ostensibly anyway, on the surface, called for the reestablishment of a national homeland for the Jewish people of the world. The land of their ancestors, known by many names, Eretz Israel, Palestine, the Holy Land, the Levant, Canaan, all those names have applied in the past, was the specific area that they chose to return to. So says the philosophy of Zionism. And the Jews continued to trickle in, as it were, and then, particularly after 1920, 1930 or so, when oppression of the Jews in Europe, Russia, and other places in the world was inclining rapidly and seriously, many more Jews, many of whom had not even previously considered the Zionist dream, started piling into Palestine. And then the horrible Holocaust of World War II committed by the Nazis, and to some degree by other ethnic groups and nations. Following the Holocaust, the stream of Jews into Palestine turned into a flood. Following World War II, a number of plans immediately after the end of World War II in 45, a number of plans were being put into place by hardline militant Zionists who eventually became militant partisans. These partisans armed themselves, and to a notable degree, they did so with weapons that they had to smuggle into Palestine, as Great Britain forbade the admission of arms, small arms, and any other forms of warfare, besides their own, of course, the Britain's own, into Palestine. So the Zionists smuggled in some of these, many of which were top-notch weapons, rifles, submachine guns, as they were called in those days, handheld machine guns, 1945, 1946, 1947, there were at least three major plans that were being formulated, which called for the execution of a takeover of Palestine away from the native Palestinian Arabs and into the hands of Jewish settlers. In November of 1947, the newly formed United Nations submitted a plan that was drafted by the Zionists for the partition, the political partition of the Palestine Mandate under Great Britain between a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews had received some 53% of the land, including the most arable, fruitful land, most livable land, leaving the rest to the native Arabs. Now, shortly after this decree by the UN for the partition, Great Britain announced that it was going, that it was on a timetable to pull itself out of Palestine after their occupation of some 28 years, 6 months hence. During those 6 months, a terrible civil war of sorts was going on in Palestine. Arab fought Jew, Jew fought Arab. Jews fought the British, committing a number of terrorist acts, most infamously the bombing of the King David Hotel. I believe that was done by Menachem Begin, future Prime Minister of Israel, directed by him under his command. A number of leaders, particularly leaders of state of Israel, Begin, Yitzhak Rabin, Shimon Peres, these guys were all generals or other officers of the partisan army of the Zionists, which later officially turned into the IDF, the Israeli so-called defense forces, which were used exclusively for the purpose of offending, for expanding the Jewish territory. They impinged upon the Arab state area that the United Nations called for and reduced its size by force of arms. By the middle of May, Great Britain declared that it was officially out of Palestine, and on the 14th of May, the Zionist leaders, the leadership that developed amongst the Jews in Palestine, pronounced the birth of the modern state of Israel. The very next day, to absolutely no surprise of the Israelis, six neighboring Arab nations sent armies in to Palestine. From the maps and things that I've studied, mostly entering into the designated, UN-designated Arab state area first. Their stated aim was to recreate order, maintain order in a very chaotic situation. And clearly, those invading Arab nations were not happy with this state of Israel that was declared against the wishes of the native Arabs. Nobody really included the Palestinians, certainly not in the initial stages of starting up a new Jewish state. And they were given only the thinnest lip service, and then only through the United Nations. Perhaps the biggest mistake of the Arabs in this episode of history was in refusing to participate in discussions involving the division of Palestine. The Palestinians had already been burned badly in a revolt which lasted from 1936 to 1939. At the end of which their leadership, their developing political leadership, the Palestinians, were either killed or exiled by Great Britain, sent away from Palestine, leaving a terrible dearth of power, lack of power for the Arabs. And that pretty much paved the way for the Israeli takeover of, let's see, that would have been 78% of historic Palestine. Israel started with over three-quarters of Palestine for their state, leaving only the well-known West Bank area on the Jordan River and the tiny Gaza Strip bordering Egypt on the Mediterranean Sea. My father, getting back to my family history here, my father was already in the United States in May of 1948. He came accompanying a cousin of his, as I understand the story, who was to marry a female cousin who was to marry someone in the New World. So he was here on family business, and he also took advantage, my father did, of the situation to make some business connections and do some business in the U.S., as he and his brother back in Palestine had their own business, bi-location hardware business with locations in Jerusalem and in Haifa on the sea. Being in the U.S., when Israel was declared into being, and to a great degree created by force of arms and intimidation and fear and killing, and the creation of a refugee problem of roughly 750,000 Palestinian Arabs, my father was not permitted to go home. Israel did not recognize his passport, which was initially issued to him by the British, nullified it, and he, along with some 60,000 other Palestinians who happened to be out of that country at the time, were never allowed to return, just as the refugees were never allowed to return, at least not as residents once again there in the land of their birth. My father lost everything that was left behind, his businesses, his property, the wealth that did not accompany him in his trip here. He even lost his business partner, who happened to have been his brother, Wadia, who was killed by the Israelis. This is basically where I'm coming from in doing the Mideast Madness show. I do not always start my show with a great deal of detail about what happened and how it pertains to my family situation. But indeed, if you are new to Mideast Madness, welcome. I want to create a dialogue on this show with the show. That was the whole idea. The nature of pirate radio here at Free Radio Santa Cruz being what it is, it, as I said, has a very small audience. But those of you who are listening, I really want you to call in and turn the show into a dialogue. Here are the phone numbers for this show. Area code 831. The first line is 427-3772. That's 427-3772. Line number two, if the first one is busy or you have a grudge against the number one. Again, area code the same, 831-469-3119. That's 469-3119. I await your call, as our tiny audience awaits your call. Perhaps the audience is not nearly so tiny as I think it may be. I endeavor to be respectful and civil in my show. Of course, I cannot possibly pretend to be completely objective and balanced, with my sentiments clearly lying with the Palestinian people. Basically, this show contains a lot of reading. I do reading of news dispatches, interesting pieces, articles. And of course, yesterday being the holiest Christian celebration of the year, Easter, I decided to read to you something which comes from Professor Mazin Kumsiye. He has a blog. Let's see, what did he call it? I get regular emailings of these. I can't remember the what he normally calls it. But this is news from Palestine, essentially. The author, Professor Mazin Kumsieh, teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Birzeit Universities in occupied Palestine. He serves as chairman of the board of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in the town of Beit Sahur. He is author of Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. And Popular Resistance in Palestine, A History of Hope and Empowerment. Let me just pass something on to you very quickly here. When you heard me use the phrase Israel slash Palestine as it is written here, that brings to mind one of the many irate comments that I read following some of these pieces that appear on various websites, blogs, and the YouTube channel. In one of those pieces, an Israeli, or person who favors Israel, referred to, as he put it, that Israel-Palestine crapola. So, there's hostility even toward the usage of that binational phraseology. Even if you mention Israel first. Okay, it's called Easter Resurrection of Palestine. Let me get comfortable here. Get past the squeaking of the microphone. Boom, the boom. Take a sip of some delicious beverage here. Again, remember to call in for any reason. Don't be shy. We want to promote dialogue. We need someone to be brave and embolden the others to call in, too. Don't worry about interrupting me. Call in at any time, area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. And here we go. Easter Resurrection of Palestine, March 31st, 2013. That was yesterday. Today in Bethlehem, sunny and warmer than usual by 10 degrees, and then parenthetically he says global warming, is Easter Sunday. It is a Sunday where Christians following the Western calendar celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. This got me thinking about resurrection, salvation, and what the real message of Jesus, the Prince of Peace, was during his short years walking in the hills that now surround me. What would Jesus do is a question that hovers in the background of this troubled land. Well, actually, the land does not have feelings to be troubled. So let us say the troubled inhabitants of this land. I am certainly troubled, as most Palestinian Christians and Muslims are. We are troubled because we cannot even get to our churches and mosques in Jerusalem. Palestinians who are already in Jerusalem are being pushed out as Israel continues its relentless program to make the city, quote-unquote, Jewish, whatever that means. On this Easter, Israeli Jewish soldiers even defiled the Church of the Sepulchre, also referred to as the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where tradition holds that Jesus was crucified and also buried. Again, I'm reading from the article Easter Resurrection in Palestine by Professor Mazin Kumsieh. His words. Continuing. We are troubled because just yesterday we commemorated Land Day, and our commemorations were marred by Israeli violence. Even trying to cling to memory of our land stolen from us is a crime of the apartheid state of Israel. A law in the Knesset tried to stop commemorations of the Nakba, Arab word for the catastrophe of ethnic cleansing of 530 villages and towns between January 1948 and December 49. But this is just one of hundreds of racist, discriminatory laws that make Israel the quintessential apartheid state. Don't forget, folks, you may call in at any point. Meanwhile, the government of Mr. Abbas, who is the president of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, the government of Mr. Abbas approved the Palestinian Authority, or PA, budget of $3.8 billion that Israeli papers said shows continued dependence on Israel and the U.S. The PA, in the meantime, have sentenced more people to jail for expressing dissatisfaction with the status quo. In one case, even sentencing a person for 6 months in jail for clicking like on a Facebook post that critiqued the PA. There is indeed a grave danger that we will have, if we do not already have, a police state serving Israeli interests. Decent people in Fatah must take note of what is being done in their name, lest we have a, quote, village league scenario. But back to our main bane, and what brought to us the disastrous Oslo and all other disasters, the Israeli occupation. Bethlehem, the Obama visit, this is written funny here. Bethlehem, the one that Obama visited for 20 minutes, is still besieged and stripped of its lands. It is still isolated from its sister cities of Jerusalem and Nazareth. We still have a permit system worse than the one practiced in apartheid South Africa. We still have Palestinian children being jailed and tortured. We still have powerful occupation stripping us of natural resources and impoverishing us. I could go on and on and on, but then I think again, what would Jesus do? He was actually in a similar situation. The Roman occupation was actually milder than the current Israeli occupation and colonization. Jesus was a Palestinian martyr. He was born in Palestine and spoke the language of my ancestors, Aramaic, the precursor of the Arabic language. He believed in resistance, like turning tables of profiteers at the table, challenging the, quote, leaders, etc. And he worked to help the poor and disenfranchised. Comfort the afflicted and make the comfortable a little less comfortable, as Dorothy Day once said. He did not spend any time congratulating the rich and powerful or visiting their palaces. When he did encounter the rich and powerful, which is to say, or for example, the Pharisees, he called them hypocrites. I use it also to describe the powerful today. For example, they speak of democracy and human rights while daily violating those. They speak of love of God, but they murder, steal, lie, and cheat to get money and resources and land of others. So I think what Jesus would do, if he was still physically walking in these hills here, is that he would join us in protests at the apartheid wall and stand in front of bulldozers uprooting olive trees and destroying Palestinian homes. He would also still be telling us to be hopeful that the Son of Man will be brought to life again and that Palestine will be free again. We Palestinians do have some experience with resurrection. Again, the words of Professor Mazin Koumsieh, a Palestinian. released just yesterday. There are, as of yesterday when I took note of this piece, there were three comments coming from the public at large. Krish Rochlau says, I wanted to say something about false history, and there you raise the issue in the linked article. I would call it anti-history. They don't replace a true history with a false history. They replace the true history with a few buzzwords and a lot of silence. They don't say that the United Kingdom, League of Nations, United Nations, and then parenthetically, thanks Stalin, maybe he thought it was a good way to get them out of Russia. Or to paraphrase an English woman on why the English government supported it. And the U.S. rubber-stamped the, quote, creation of Israel. And then, when the UN and UK lost their nerve, Jewish settlers pushed through the partition of Palestine by force of arms. No account at all, but only some bogus terms. So some Zionists say Israel got, quote, independence. From whom? Some say Israel was created. Do they mean God created it? Blasphemy is only possible if you believe in God, right? To borrow another current aphorism, God believes in you. That was a quote of Professor Kunsier's article. Second comment by Sam. My thoughts and prayers are with you, especially on this most sacred day in our calendar. Third and final comment on the article by Marty. In Australia. The tragedy of Israel and Palestine is that the Zionists, who have suffered immeasurably, are now the cause of the suffering of the Palestinians. Whereas the U.S. and many other nations came to the aid of the Jews in Germany, the suffering of the Palestinians is mostly ignored. As one who spent over 2 months in the West Bank and witnessed firsthand the building of the settlements, the effects of the wall, and the closures, the destruction of Palestinian homes and land and crops, I wish to commend the actions and writing of Mazin Kumsier as the Palestinian I admire the most of the people I met. Whatever he writes or advocates or participates in, I take note of, as he is extremely gifted in what he does, is fair and just, and has the spirit of reconciliation. If only there were more leaders like him. Thank you, Mazin, for continuing your leadership and commitment to Palestine. Again, from Marty in Sydney. A fairly short piece to kick off the show, and it's already 3:35 p.m. on Monday, April 1st, 2013. Let's see, what do I, Ren, want to comment about? I welcome his inclusion of the phrase, what would Jesus do? As it brings to mind immediately for me the bumper sticker that I have in the back of my car. Jesus is Palestinian. And the brief accostment that I experienced at the post office in town where I live, as I got out of my car, a little old lady started yelling at me, Jesus is Palestinian, blah, blah, blah. He was Jewish. And my immediate response to that was, well, no, I really can't forget what I said immediately, but I don't think it was hostile at all. But in very short order, she, by this time, for me anyway, obviously a little old Jewish lady who declared that she's been to Israel, she's spent time in Israel, perhaps lived there, gave me a very, very brief 20-second history lesson about how, as she put it, the Palestinians could have had a, quote, glorious homeland, as she put it. And I'm not sure where what she was referring to. She may have been referring to the UN partition of Palestine in 47 and 48. She could have been referring to the perception that the Palestinians dismissed offers of peace from the Israelis, which were always bogus offers and always blown out of proportion to the ear of the Western world, to be made to look, to make the Palestinians look selfish and unreasonable. Another story for another time. And at any rate, I went into the post office and came back, and then she walked up to me again, this time in a calm voice, apologizing. As she put it, if she came on too strong or something like that. But again, in very short order, she returned to her persisting arguments and admonishments of me for the bumper sticker and for whatever else she perceived in me. And I became frustrated and a little afraid. I mean, I'm sure that I could have taken her on physically, but it's funny how I become afraid at things that are not necessarily real. And I says to her, listen, if you continue to harass me, I'm going to call the police. I said that to her. And she said, well, I'm not harassing you. And that pretty much ended the conversation between us, as it were. So getting back to the article, my comments on the article, yeah, why can't more people embrace the aphorism, what would Jesus do? A question that hovers in the background of this troubled land, as the professor put it. March 30th is Land Day, which is a commemoration not of 1948 or 56 or 67 or 73, but of a dispute which happened within the bounds of the Israeli state, the Jewish state, in 1976, where six Palestinians were killed in a protest. Perhaps the Israelis thought that these dangerous, unarmed six Palestinians posed some threat to them in their protest and in their desire to hang on to land that was being expropriated by the government authority of Israel. Land Day, 1976, March 30th, the day before Israel. The day before Easter in this particular year. And the commemorations were marred by Israeli violence. Even trying to cling to memory of our land stolen from us, as the professor says in the article, trying to cling to the memory of our lands is a crime in the apartheid state of Israel. A law in the Knesset tried to stop commemorations of the Nakba. Well, I guess the law did not go through or was knocked down in court or something, because he says they tried to create the law. Now, Mazin states that there are hundreds of racist discriminatory laws that make Israel the quintessential apartheid state. Hundreds, according to the professor's way of counting. The people at Jewish Voice for Peace state in their Occupation 101 educational material that there are some 20 laws. And this is a pro-Palestinian, pro-justice and peace group, Jewish Voice for Peace. They state that there are some 20 laws on the books in Jerusalem which openly discriminate against native Arabs, or as the Israelis call them, Israeli Arabs, as opposed to Israeli Palestinians or just Palestinians. Even though Palestinians have the vote, which of course they could not be denied once Israeli came into being and wanted to be known as a democratic state, they threw the bone of a vote to the Arabs, which brings to mind something else I read that Vladimir Lenin declared at one point, is that Well, Lenin declared that religion is the opium of the people. Here in the United States, Emma Goldman, an early advocate for human rights and socialism, declared that voting is the opium of the people. So anyway, that I'm lessening the importance of the individual vote. It was permitted to make Israel look good and to fend off criticism of a false democracy, which it is anyway. So despite the right to vote, to serve in the military, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a thing that's good for Arabs, serving in the Israeli military, and positions of high stature and importance, judgeships, members of the Knesset, etc. Again, there are a few Palestinian Arab members of the Knesset who have little real pull with their vote in their form of the parliament. The Israelis in charge know this. They just they consistently point to the vote and the seats of the Knesset, which prove supposedly that Israel is a democracy. But there are these other breaches of the rights of Palestinians, 20 or 100, however you count them, that have to do with the with the recognition of property rights and the recognition of the ownership of water and the sources of water. They have to do with intermarriage between Jews and Muslims, Jews and Christians. And these laws generally favor the rights of the Israelis over the lesser rights of the Palestinians. The overall single dichotomy, the inherent hypocrisy of a democracy for everyone in Israel, is the fact that Israel is designed to be and still endeavors by the most powerful in government to be an all-Jewish state, an exclusively Jewish state that was designed and built to be a homeland for Jews and Jews only. I don't know what they're going to do with the 20% of the population. That's 1 in 5 people who live in Israel who are not Jews. Okay, continuing with the commentary. Qumsiyeh admits that the Palestinian Authority has sentenced some of his own people to jail for expressing dissatisfaction with the status quo. Status quo has been referred to by critics as an Israeli occupation management tool of the Israelis, and I have to agree with that. By referring to the disastrous Oslo Accords and other attempted peace accords with the Israelis, how could that be so disastrous? Well, one of the conditions laid out for everyone over there, both Israelis and Palestinians, included items that were favorable to each side, but in reality, the only ones that really mattered came into existence for the Israelis only. They were more legally permitted to station troops on the West Bank border with the country of Jordan, the nation of Jordan, and other potential access points around on the perimeters of the West Bank, and allowed them to do other things, which continues to impinge on the rights and the lifestyles and the economy of the Palestinians. But life has changed little. for the people of Palestine, the people of the West Bank and of the Gaza Strip. Little for the better, anyway. Oslo fell apart for a number of reasons, as I see it, not the least of which is that the government in Jerusalem continued and continues to this day to push for continued expansion of Israeli settlements in occupied Palestine, in the West Bank, in East Jerusalem. Jerusalem has seen shameless ethnic cleansing for some years now, whereas the Oslo Accords called for, or at least called for, the movement towards East Jerusalem becoming the capital of an independent and sovereign state of Palestine, and a secure one, I might add. That was the hope. As Oslo, over time, came laid to waste, the Israelis have deliberately and oh so blatantly kicked out tens of thousands of Palestinian residents of East Jerusalem so this would not happen. So this would not occur. That's what the professor is talking about here. He's talking about this, the occupation stripping Palestine of its natural resources and impoverishing them. Of course, he's talking about the establishment and expansion, never-ending expansion of the Israeli settlements there, which take, and keep squeezing the Palestinian people farther from the borders of Israel. And that oh-so-wonderful security fence slash wall that is supposed to protect the country of Israel from terrorists outside of Israel, namely the West Bank, from coming and blowing themselves up or whatever in the cities of Israel. That wall, fence, whatever, also surrounds and protects and in effect guarantees the unhindered expansion of those Jewish settlements. And in doing so, utterly Bantusizes. You've heard the term the Bantustans of Palestine. The word was taken from Africa, most likely I would think South Africa, when they talk about black population areas under that apartheid regime. And they're largely disconnected, the fence even cutting across the property, straight through the properties of many Palestinians' farms and homes, even their towns. I don't think that's by accident. That's one of the purposes of the wall, is to decimate Palestinian society, physically decimate them. Now, I wanted to say one more, maybe a couple more things. Oh, he makes reference, he says, he uses the quote from Dorothy Day, "Comfort the afflicted and make the comfortable a little less comfortable." Dorothy Day was, like Emma Goldman, back in the 20s and 30s, for her time anyway, a free living and free loving, as I understand it, liberated type feminist for her day, Dorothy Day, who not too long before her death I heard speaking, of course, is a very old woman in St. Paul, Minnesota, at a place I don't think it was a Salvation Army, but a place like that which attempts to fulfill some of the needs of the homeless and the impoverished. I did hear her speak, so she's a real person. And they, at least over here in the U.S., they made a TV movie out of her. And that's who Dorothy Day was. He really gets kind of speaking of Jesus, in the end of his short article here, he gets kind of spacey, maybe a little, even a little unreverent. He says, "So I think what Jesus would do if he was still physically walking in these hills here is that he would join us in protests at the apartheid wall and stand in front of bulldozers uprooting olive trees and destroying Palestinian homes," a reference, of course, to the late Rachel Corrie, who just a little over 10 years ago, last month, an American from the state of Washington, died doing exactly that, holding a sign up for the driver of a military bulldozer with shields on it, physical metal shields, could read the sign. Witnesses to the event testified that clearly the driver of the bulldozer saw Ms. Corrie as she tried to prevent it from demolishing homes in Gaza, in the Gaza Strip. And he ends the article by saying, "He would also still be telling us to be hopeful that the Son of Man will be brought to life again and that Palestine will be free again. We Palestinians do have some experience with resurrection." Well, on the one hand, those two closing statements can be considered irreverent, blasphemous. On the other hand, I think the man means what he says. Professor Mazin Koumsieh, who lives in Palestine, teaches and does research at Bethlehem and Beerside Universities, serves as chairman of the board of the Palestinian Center for Rapprochement Between People and coordinator of the Popular Committee Against the Wall and Settlements in Beit Zahur, author of at least two books. Okay. It's 6 minutes before the hour here on the west coast of North America. Monday, April 1st, 2013. This is the Mideast Madness Show. My name is Ren Tawil, and I am a Palestinian American. Returning to the folder I have dedicated in part to this show. I am again engaging in a lovely beverage. Stand by. I'm looking at Stuart's CD here to decide what else people might want to listen to. Okay. I'm going to do one of his personal very favorite numbers. This is entitled Universe Communion, wherein Stuart Davis, whom I obviously adore, he's going to be in town, by the way, here in Santa Cruz at the Crepe Place next Monday evening. Live already. In Universe Communion, Stuart talks about his take on ufology and what we can expect from the aliens, the friendly aliens.
There was a star that was hidden in space, an undiscovered gem. Until its denizens decided they had chosen the dagon to give the gift to them. shocking revelations of a primitive people. Our knowledge was redefined. Enlightened and wise, a simple African tribe has educated the modern minds. Our potential's choked under the scientific yoke. Afraid that if we move and open our eyes, we'll have to realize that if a message from a distant sun can reach us, there is a magic that is waiting and is willing to teach us how to suture every soul in a one-concentric hole. We'll find a perfect union in a universe communion. In this arena of Western thought, the spirit is in a vice. We're driven to seek, but it's a futile pursuit with the means that won't suffice. It is a science with a limited scope, where the heart and head collide. Designed to the laws of only tangible proof, to which the truth does not abide. We stifle and smother the mystic wonder. Or is our arrogance a deafening fear? Have to hear. But if a message from a distant sun can reach us, there is a magic that is waiting and is willing to teach us how to suture every soul in the one concentric hole. Earth will find a perfect union in a universe community. Tendency to think that it's the practical senses that get these questions solved. There's tenuous tools, and the more we employ them, the slower that we evolve. Denied by suppression.
It is 1600 hours plus 1 minute here in Santa Cruz County, California. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. Streaming live at freakradio.org. That's F-R-E-A-K, freakradio.org. I'll give you the phone numbers again. Area code 831-427-3772. The next line, the second line, is 469-3119. Or niner, as they'd say in the Marines. No, I wasn't in the Marines. I was in the Minnesota Air Guard for a time. Please do not forget that we are indeed an underground free pirate radio service, which is one long, consistent manifestation of civil disobedience against the FCC and the other powers that would otherwise limit our speech on the airwaves and over the net. We are forbidden by our own charter from receiving donations from corporate entities and fat cats. Some fat cats, anyway. Sugar daddies, whatever you want to amusingly refer to them as. So we need your donations from the little people, from the not-so-powerful citizens of these United States or anywhere else in the world where you can hear me. Up in the space station, if you can hear me, slip a check in the mail yourselves and send that generous or humble or both donation to Free Radio Santa Cruz or simply FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, C-R-U-Z, California, 95061. Again, please send your donations to support this service and this show to FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip 95061. In the article that I dwelt on during the first hour of the show, Professor Mazin Kumsie referred to the deliberate impoverishment of his fellow Palestinians in their own lands, in the occupied territories, by the Israeli settlements, and how those settlements, getting bigger and bigger all the time, continue to exploit the resources of the Palestinians and simultaneously making it difficult or impossible for the Palestinians to use those resources. A perfect example of this is the production, the manufacture of a product which is called SodaStream here in outlets in this part of the world, in California, where it is sold. SodaStream is a kitchen appliance which carbonates tap water, so you can do wonderful things with that. Unfortunately, it is manufactured in the industrial park, massive industrial park, of one of these illegal occupation settlements in the West Bank. They use land, minerals, and water in this production process. Land, minerals, and water all being properly in the, should be the possession of the Palestinians who live there. The Israelis are exploiting resources of the native peoples, just as we here in the U.S. and Canada and other places in the Americas, the Europeans have done to the resources of which very little was asked by the native people who lived and continue to live here. Same kind of thing. The plight of the indigenous around the world. So we're asking people to boycott SodaStream. You can go to sodastream.org. This is a human rights issue. Palestinians do not receive any profits from the products made in occupied territories by the Israeli settlers which use Palestinian resources. A reminder that the international boycott of firms that supported apartheid in South Africa helped to overturn that racist regime. And yes, Israel is a racist power. We can do it again, folks. You can go to boycottsodastream.org. In the name of human rights, boycott SodaStream. And Free Radio Santa Cruz, ardently being anti-hatred, anti-needless hostile provocation. We do have a standing policy against racist speech, homophobic speech, misogyny, don't want to get that word mixed up. And of course, we look down upon and forbid hate speech. Well, now, if I'm an Arab, one of those awful Palestinians that people expect the most hateful things from, particularly against Jews, if any of you are so utterly expectant of such hate, that degree of hate to come out of my mouth, listen to this, and without violating the rules, we'll blow off some steam here. For the hate lovers out there, this is called 9 Things I Hate About Everyone, equally, no matter what their religion, color, faith, nationality. 9 Things I Hate About Everyone. 1. People appoint at their risk while asking for the time. I know where my watch is, pal. Where the hell is yours? Do I point at my crotch when I ask where the toilet is? 2. People who are willing to get off their ass to search the entire room for the TV remote because they refuse to walk to the TV and change the channel manually. 3. When people say, oh, you just want to have your cake and eat it too. Damn right. What good is cake if you can't eat it? 4. When people say, it's always the last place you look. Of course it is. Why the hell would you keep looking after you found it? Do people do this? Who and where are they? I'm going to kick their asses. 5. When people say while watching a film, did you see that? No, loser, I paid $12 to come to the cinema and stare at the damn floor. 6. People who ask, can I ask you a question? Didn't really give me a choice there, did you, sunshine? 7. When something is, quote, new and improved, which is it? If it's new, then there has never been anything like it before. If it's an improvement, then there must have been something before it. Couldn't be new. 8. When people say, life is short. What the hell? Life is the longest damn thing anyone ever does. What can you do that's longer? What can you do that's longer? 9. When you're waiting for the bus and someone asks, has the bus come yet? If the bus came, would I be standing here, dumbass? There. I've gotten that off my chest. And that's all the hate or hateful sentiment you're going to hear from me today. I promise. Well, at least intentionally. 9 things I hate about everyone. My sister sent that by way of my mother. All right, stop laughing. Back to business, folks. The tens of thousands of you who are out there listening to my show at this very moment. Let's simmer down out there. Settle down. We have finished with Professor Cumcier's Easter Resurrection of Palestine. Now, here's a much longer piece. The show normally goes until 5 minutes before 5 and 1611 hours right now on the west coast of North America. From Alternative Insight. Those phone numbers again are area code 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. From the Alternative Insight website. Original articles that maintain relevance on foreign and domestic policies, Middle East crisis, politics and media. Combating hype and conditioning by presenting an insight that is an alternative to conventional media. Solving the world's problems one article at a time. A little plug that I felt free enough to describe alternative insight. Oh, by the way, here's the disclaimer. Alternative insight presents news and views that are alternatives to the conventional media. The news and views don't necessarily represent those of alternative insight. Copyright notice. Articles, unless otherwise noted, are original in the property of alternative insight. Use is encouraged and permitted in accord with fair use guidelines that credit alternative insight. Well, I'm giving them plenty of air here and plenty of recognition. Other than that, folks out there, don't do as I say. Don't do as I do. Do as I say. Do as I read. And I'll continue in part to go on breaking the law here. Okay, from Alternative Insight, this is entitled Manipulating the World to Destruction. I could not find any one individual author. This is just something from Alternative Insight, Manipulating the World to Destruction. The Middle East crisis has reached a decisive point. And by the way, this is dated April of 2013. From the entry of a relatively few Zionists to Palestine, the trajectory of the crisis has monotonically pursued a direction toward complete Zionist control of former Palestinian lands and complete disruption of Palestinian life. A startled world wonders how this happened, while neglecting the social and psychological manipulations that preceded each stage of the Zionists' forward movement. Unaware of this strategy of conditioning, the world fails to apply necessary countermeasures and halt a more far-reaching conflagration. Let me interrupt here. Obviously, this is the kind of thing you've heard, particularly from my lips in this show before. Rather standard, somewhat general description of the situation there. But hang in there, bear with. There are some really interesting things in here. And again, this website being what it is, Alternative Insight, it's a bloggy kind of thing. There's a lot of opinion, but there are also a lot of facts. Okay, continuing with the article now, second paragraph. Manipulating a world to enhance a nation's interests is not unique, and especially for a country that is a global economic and military power. Citizens relish the strength that gives them respect and advantages, refuse to regard the harm done to others, and are blinded to the eventual retribution. Napoleon and Queen Victoria convinced their own and colonial subjects, for a while, that their armies, navies, and administrations brought civilization and prosperity to subdued peoples. Nazi Germany had approval of its nationals and many peoples from other nations as its panzers swept across a Europe that Hitler posed as one to which Germany would bring stability, peace, and cleared of what he defined as the, quote, scourge of liberalism, end quote. The United States spread its influence with slogans bringing freedom and democracy, until injured people surveyed their dead and wounded and realized these were dubious phrases. And expanding Israel is unique. Although not starting as a global economic and military power, Israel has advanced its frontiers with its own manipulations, convincing a part of the world that its development has been defensive, a reaction to events, and honestly implemented. Can we trust the words of a nation that, for whatever reason, occupies other people's lands, has forced out the native peoples, committed a myriad of proven atrocities, changes daily the landmarks and artifacts of history to suit its agenda, and has maintained generations of Palestinians in oppressive and captive conditions. The manipulated scenario describes dispersed Jews seeking a national home, obtaining it after fleeing the World War II Holocaust and arriving in the land of their ancestors, which, as Israeli education teaches students, was given to them by a vote from the United Nations. Because of consistent attacks upon the Yishuv, the Hebrew name for the Jewish residents in Palestine, and their Israeli descendants were forced to defend themselves. Conflicts caused turmoil, and a major part of the Arab population of Palestine became displaced. Continuous wars, forced upon Israel by adjacent Arab nations, pushed development of a strong military whose decisive victories captured territory for defensive purposes. I'll break in here again. These are the words of the author, whoever she or he is, from Alternative Insight, who is endeavoring to describe the manipulated scenario which pushes the Israeli agenda. Okay, back to the article. Continuous wars forced upon Israel by adjacent Arab nations pushed development of a strong military whose decisive victories captured territory for defensive purposes. For security reasons, Israel expanded its boundaries and placed immigrants in strategic locations in the West Bank. Roads and a security wall, which happens to cut through Palestinian lands, became necessary in order to prevent terrorists from entering the homeland. Security measures demanded absolute control of Palestinian movements. Unfortunately, a poorly directed and recalcitrant Palestinian community has been responsible for its decline and egregious fate. Facts create a contradictory scenario, which will have its detractors. However, any refutation should argue with the facts and not the overall scenario. And again, folks, like a number of other pieces that I have read to you on this show over the air and the net, might sound a tad too intellectual and big wordy. It's not really that bad. Not as bad as some others that I've read. So, kiddies, let's put on our little thinking caps and focus. Again, this is an article entitled Manipulating the World to Destruction, which can be found on the Alternative Insight website. History contradicts the portrayal of Zionism as a mass movement by the Jewish people. The Zionist message prompted nations to question the loyalty of their Jewish citizens, served to impede their advances, and reinforced a race-baiting theory that Jews engaged in international conspiracies. Proof is shown by the Russian Jews, who had major problems and did not consider Zionism as relief for their difficulties. Between 1881 and 1914, 2.5 million Jews migrated from Russia, 1.7 million to America, about 500,000 to Western Europe, almost 300,000 to other nations, and only 30 to 50,000 to Palestine. And the editor puts in inserts a factoid here. 15,000 returned to Russia, by the way. Plans for establishing a nation on Palestinian lands occurred long before World War II, and therefore the World War II Holocaust had no relation to the Zionist concept for the creation of a state. The settlers, of whom only 180,000 came from refugee camps, we're talking about Jews now, Jewish refugee camps, arrived in Palestine with no more verified connection, key phrase there, with the ancient Hebrews than many other ethnicities. Known to archaeology and accepted history, not biblical history, as mainly wandering tribes that established themselves in hilltop areas of Canaan, the predecessory word for Palestine, historic Palestine, the Hebrews never formed a vibrant civilization or a unified nation of extensive administrative territory. Not only is it unproven that the land to which European Zionists returned was a land of their forefathers, but the claim is supercilious. In a world of democratic law, legal qualifications, not self-proclaimed and spurious identifications that span thousands of years, determine land ownership, and the Zionists had no legal claims, while Palestinian people had occupied and tilled the area for generations. In my own editor's note here, my reader's note, not merely for generations, but in some cases for hundreds, even over 1,000 years. Returning. Identification of Hebrews as Jews happened principally during the 5th century before Christ, after Hebrews returned from exile in Persia with a more complete vision of monotheistic Judaism, and later in Mesopotamia during the 5th century AD, where the center of rabbinical Judaism composed the main body of Jewish law, the Babylonian, not the Jerusalem, Talmud. Hang in there, my friends. Okay, skip 1,500 years to the 1948 war, when 700,000 Palestinians fled their homes and Israel refused to allow them to return to their ancestral lands. During the Palestinian exodus, known atrocities, forcible evictions, and brutal attacks, all planned to intimidate Palestinian families to leave, have been documented. Israel destroyed 411 Arab villages and engaged in several wars with its neighbors, in which the kill ratio overwhelmingly favored Israel, and by which Israel doubled its original territory. For more than 60 years, Palestinians have seen their lands appropriated and their lives controlled by an Israel military authority. The Israeli army occupies the Jordan Valley, as I was talking about earlier here, slowly clears it of Palestinian presence, while Israeli settlers, mostly immigrants from foreign nations, occupy the West Bank and East Jerusalem. All these endeavors have been declared legal by several United Nations. I'm sorry, I will read that again. All these endeavors by the Israelis have been declared illegal, not legal, by several United Nations resolutions. Several UN resolutions. Don't forget, folks, if you have any comments about what I'm saying, call me at 831-427-3772 or 469-3119. Phone lines are open. I see no lights flashing on them, though. One way or the other, or perhaps mostly neutral, give me a call. Let's talk about this. As I tried to tell people last week, I do not want this program to be just another of many, many, countless propaganda forums, or non-forums, as it were, either for the Palestinian side of the question or the Israeli side of the question. This is not meant to be exclusively pro-Muslim, Arab, pro-Christian, pro-Jewish, pro-Israel. Let's share the discussion. Anything I say, you can call me on. Literally call me on, over the phone on. Back to the article. President Barack Obama's recent voyage to Israel exposes and emphasizes the conditioning of the world community to acceptance of the Zionist agenda. It is difficult to believe, then, that an erudite President Obama prepared the speech. Examine some of his statements. A born witness to the ancient history of the Jewish people at the Shrine of the Book. The Shrine of the Book only houses the Dead Sea Scrolls and the Aleppo Codex, which are controversial rewrites of biblical scrolls and not historical documents. Touring Jerusalem's Rockefeller Archaeological Museum and the Bible Lands Museum, which is across from the Shrine of the Book, demonstrates that there are few significant artifacts of an established Hebrew civilization in the Middle East. No constructions other than those from the Omri era, nor statues, monuments, roads, ships, national commerce, military equipment, treasures, jewelry, communication, transportation, and other than the Bible, no significant documents that have survived and can be attributed to the efforts of the ancient Hebrews before the 6th century Babylonian invasion of the Levant. And again, Levant is another name which historically has been attached to the land of Palestine / the land of Israel. Apparently this is a continuation of Mr. Obama's insights. It's a story of centuries of slavery and years of wandering in the desert, a story of perseverance amidst persecution and faith in God and the Torah. It's a story about finding freedom in your own land. And for the Jewish people, this story is central to you, to who you become. But it's also a story that holds within it the universal human experience, with all of its suffering, but also all of its salvation. These are biblical stories, refuted by Israel's most recognized archaeologists and historians, such as Professor Ze'ev Herzog, in Deconstructing the Walls of Jericho, Haaretz magazine, October 29, 1999. Although the ancient Egyptians maintained detailed recordings of their lives, and later academics compile that history, no historical evidence has been presented of centuries of Hebrew slavery and their years of wandering in the desert. The Sinai Desert has never exposed the wanderings, and the Hebrew language did not exist during the supposed time. The Exodus story, quote-unquote Exodus story, did not free the Jews. Just the opposite. It has been used to keep Jews in perpetual bondage, to a false history, and to promote an attitude of constant victimhood, while distracting them from realizing they might also play a role in the injustices done to others. It is 1630 hours Pacific Daylight Time, 4:30 in the afternoon. We have some 25 minutes left of program here on Mideast Madness. Back to the Obama quotation. Notes from his speech while in Israel. For the Jewish people, the journey to the promise of the State of Israel wound through countless generations. It invoked centuries of suffering and exile, prejudice and pogroms, and even genocide. Through it all, the Jewish people sustained their unique identity, traditions, as well as a longing to return home. And while Jews achieved extraordinary success in many parts of the world, the dream of true freedom finally found its full expression in the Zionist idea to be a free people in your homeland. That's why I believe that Israel is rooted not just in history and tradition, but also in a simple and profound idea. The idea that people deserve to be free and in a land of their own. mostly true, except for using the concept of a Jewish people. Two persons make a people, but a people don't make a nation. A nation refers to a community of people who share a common language, culture, ethnicity, descent, and history. The Jews, similar to the Mennonites, Jehovah's Witnesses, Basques, and myriads of other religious and ethnic groups, did not share the characteristics of a nation. If it were otherwise, why has Israel thrust been to give its Jews a new scaffolding of a nation, a common language, culture, descent, and history? The Mizrahi, who came to Israel, were Arabs. The Europeans were Ashkenazi. The Ethiopians were Falasha, and the Yemenites were from the Arabian Peninsula. The differing languages, dialects, music, cultures, and heritage of these ethnicities were discarded and replaced by unique and uniform characteristics. And with this destruction of each community went the destruction of centuries-old Jewish history and life in Tunisia, Iraq, Libya, and Egypt. All these immigrants became a new Jew, an Israeli Jew, which, unlike the Iraqi Jews, who were probably the closest relatives to the ancient Jews, had no proven aspects of the biblical Hebrews. If Obama is sincere in helping people from their journey as a people to a nation, he should give attention to the aspirations of the Kurds, Assyrians, and the Nubians. Each of these peoples, who have suffered greatly throughout history and still suffer today, especially the 3 million Assyrians, have all the elements of a people and were well recognized and established as nations in previous eras. Maybe a little prejudice and favoritism to others permits them to be disregarded. Mr. Obama again. I know Israel is taking risks for peace. Brave leaders, Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Rabin, reached treaties with two of your neighbors. You made credible proposals to the Palestinians at Annapolis. You withdrew from Gaza and Lebanon, and then faced terror and rockets. Across the region, you've extended a hand of friendship, and all too often you've been confronted with rejection and, in some cases, the ugly reality of anti-Semitism. So, I believe that the Israeli people do want peace, and I also understand why too many Israelis, maybe an increasing number, maybe a lot of young people here today, are skeptical that it can be achieved. Back to the author's words. The two mentioned Israeli leaders could never redeem themselves for their severe atrocities against the Palestinians. Begin held office as prime minister during the first invasion of Lebanon and during the attacks on the Palestinian refugee camps at Sabra and Shatila in Lebanon. Excerpts from the Kahan Commission report, which investigated the massacres. On the evening of September 16, 1982, a force of about 150 phalangists, one group of Lebanese Arab Christians, entered the Sabra and Shatila camps under Israeli protection. It subsequently developed that instead of restoring order, the phalangists perpetrated a massacre in the camps. Estimates of the number of people killed and missing vary from about 460 Red Cross estimates to 700, Israeli Defense Forces intelligence estimate to 2,000 Palestinian estimates. There is no doubt that the victims included women and children as well as unarmed men, and were mostly not Palestinian fighters killed in the heat of battle. Mostly not Palestinian fighters. The Kahan Commission determined that Ariel Sharon and several others were at least negligent in their duty and should have known that there was a danger that such massacres might occur. Under these circumstances, they should not have permitted the Falangists to enter the camps, or should have at least taken steps to ensure that no massacres occurred, or should have intervened to investigate and stop the massacres once suspicious reports began coming out of camps. Now, in the words of the article, Yitzhak Rabin was responsible for the Palestinian exodus from Lydda and Ramleh in 1948. Historian Benny Morris wrote in Operation Dani and the Palestinian Exodus from Lydda and Ramleh in 1948, Middle East Journal, page 40. Quote, at 1330 hours on 12 July 1948, Lieutenant Colonel Yitzhak Rabin, Operation Dani Head, issued the following order. 1. The inhabitants of Lydda must be expelled quickly without attention to age. They should be directed to Bait Nabala. Implement immediately. A similar order was issued at the same time to the Kiryati Brigade concerning the inhabitants of the neighboring town of Ramleh, occupied by Kiryati troops that morning. On 12 and 13 July, the Yafta Brigades carried out their orders expelling the 50 to 60,000 remaining inhabitants of and refugees camped in and around the two towns. End quote. Chief of Staff of the Israeli Defense Forces during the 1967 war, Yitzhak Rabin was responsible for expelling about 5,000 inhabitants from three villages in the area between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Post of 24 October 1991 reported that Rabin admitted on a Canadian TV program that he gave the order to destroy the villages. The inhabitants were not allowed to return nor bury their dead. Rabin, as defense minister, is also known for the infamous Break Their Bones decree during the first Intifada, which began in 1987, a means to make impotent the Palestinian male population. Reports had Palestinian youngsters rounded up from their homes, brought to remote areas, and while soldiers held them, had their bones smashed. Amira Haas in Haaretz, November 4th, 2005, described the feelings, quote, when Palestinians were asked about Rabin, and they said this. This is what they remember. One thinks of his hand scarred by soldiers' beatings. Another remembers a friend who flitted between life and death in the hospital for 12 days after he was beaten by soldiers who caught him drawing a slogan on a wall during a curfew. Yet another remembers the Al-Aman refugee camp during the first Intifada. All its young men were hoping, were hopping on crutches or were in casts, because they had thrown stones at soldiers, who in turn chased after them and carried out Rabin's order. End description. Prime Ministers Begin and Shamir were known terrorists during the British Mandate, the former Begin being responsible for the bombing of the King David Hotel, and the latter accused for playing a role in the assassination of UN Representative Foch Bernadotte. Manipulations prevented indictments and trial for their criminal activities. Israel leadership, except for Moshe Sharet, who was forced to resign the office due to his conciliatory attitude toward the Palestinians, all the others have been nationalist hawks, have encroached upon Palestinian lands, and those, after 1967, pursued a policy of West Bank settlements. The rest of Obama's appraisals in the former paragraph of his speech is subject to interpretation, and it is doubtful that much of the world interprets the happenings as he expressed them. Here, in this small strip of land that has been the center of so much of the world's history, so much triumph and so much tragedy, Israelis have built something that few could have imagined 65 years ago. Final quote from Mr. Obama. Israel deserves praise for its progress. However, this description is severely exaggerated and constantly repeated. Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, South Korea, the Emirates, South Africa, and many other countries have shown more dynamic growth since 1950 and, unlike Israel, achieved the progress without huge aid from the United States and Germany. Israel's major cities of Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Jerusalem, except for the Old City, are nondescript in appearance and tepid in activity. Amman, Jordan, with its engineering marvels of tunnels and bridges, has much more appeal than Tel Aviv. A trip through Israel does not reveal any special advancements. Some interesting tourist areas and sterile urban areas with pockets of poverty and deterioration. As for making the desert bloom, bring in irrigation and anything will bloom. Maybe Israel's irrigation and desalination methods are slightly more advanced, but Israel does not have any proprietary methods that money cannot buy. The Negev, the desert of the southern part of Palestine, controlled by Israel, is no more vital than Phoenix, Arizona, or the farms that Qatar is building in the desert. Look at it another way. Israel has used huge quantities of water in a water-deficient area and has destroyed the appearance of the biblical lambs they claim to cherish and which the Palestinians preserved for centuries. We're down to the last two paragraphs, people. At the Paris Peace Conference, following the First World War, the Zionists stated their mission, and Israel has intended to fulfill that mission, incorporate all of former Palestine and maybe more into one Jewish state, or have nothing. And no Israeli prime minister dares to deter the Zionist state from its ultimate objective. Unlike much of the world, the Arab nations are cognizant of Israel's plans and scramble to prevent them. Despite the manipulation of rhetoric, the Arab world and Iran are consigned to an Israeli state. But not this Israeli state. Not to a military state of exclusiveness, which treats Arabs as inferiors and promotes a singular group. The world faces two choices. Permit Israel to continue its expansionist policies and destroy the Middle East, or bring democratic changes and level-headed government to an Israel that is willing to share the country with its original landowners. The latter removes a major impediment to instability and conflict in the Middle East. Naturally, a corrupt and manipulated world will accept the former and hasten its own destruction. I'll read that last paragraph again, at least to make sure I understand it. The world faces two choices. Permit Israel to continue its expansionist policies and destroy the Middle East, as it is, or bring democratic change and level-headed government to an Israel that is willing to share the country with the original landowners. The latter removes a major impediment to instability and conflict in the Middle East. Naturally, a corrupt and manipulated world will accept the former and hasten its own destruction. From Alternative Insight, dated April 2013, Alternative Insight at earthlink.net. Okay, that was quite a quite a bit to read and to listen to, I'm sure. I thank you for sticking with me. Those who are still awake and still listening. 8 minutes of the show left. I should make some comments. The one paragraph which appeared in the second half of this did appear on the webpage as a kind of introduction to the article. The Exodus story did not free the Jews. Just the opposite. It has been used to keep Jews in perpetual bondage to a false history and to promote an attitude of constant victimhood while distracting them from realizing they might also play a role in the injustices done to others. I think that says something about where the author, whoever she or he is coming from. Some would say reality turned upside down. The reality they were read to and taught about as children in their congregations, temples, Christian churches, and perhaps to some point even in Islamic mosques. People do indeed cling on to stories that are rooted in time. In many cases, the deeper in time, the stronger the roots, and the greater the impossibility of uprooting them and reteaching a true history. Bitter rivals to this reality would call the teachers of the truth revisionist historians, such as those anti-Semites who don't want the world to believe that the Holocaust really did occur. I think that's where the term revisionist historians and revisionist history might have first come from or might have became popular. I'm not saying that the Holocaust did not happen. I'm just talking about some of the places where I pick this stuff up from. And no, I have not read to any depth the details of the arguments that the Holocaust deniers have made. I just know that these descriptions have been made about them from people of one persuasion or the other. Quite a charge to entitle this manipulating the world to destruction. Obviously, this is someone, the author here, who sees the worst possible outcome from the nurturing and coddling of an all-Jewish state and maintaining its military supremacy, its QME, qualitative military edge, over all its Arab neighbors. They expect the worst. The author makes interesting analogies to Napoleon and Queen Victoria, who convinced their own and colonial subjects, for a while anyway, that their armies, navies, and administrations brought civilization and prosperity to subdued peoples. Nazi Germany had approval of its nationals, and many people from other nations as its panzer tank division swept across Europe that Hitler posed as one to which Germany would bring stability and peace, and cleared of what he defined as the scourge of liberalism. And, of course, the United States spread its influence with slogans of bringing freedom and democracy until those injured peoples surveyed their dead and wounded and realized these were dubious phrases. You know, it wasn't just the so-called American Indians, North America's indigenous peoples, who suffered under manifest destiny, as the Europeans famously call their activities. Mexico was set upon by Washington, the city of the U.S. administration at the time in the 1840s. Not just the new territories, which would have tripled their size that they had acquired from Spain. The U.S. became jealous and decided that it wanted those territories to link the East, the Atlantic, to the Pacific, particularly to California, which had already been made a state of the Union. And not only did the U.S. invade those new Mexican territories, but they invaded Mexico and its capital itself. From the Caribbean, they landed Marines in Veracruz on the coast, and they fought their way with remarkable ease, I might add, to Mexico City. We did the same thing to the Mexicans, and there was a great deal of racist backup in the media for these activities. A 19th century fascism, which continued to refer to the Mexicans as an inferior people who had to be eradicated from lands that supposedly rightfully belonged to the white recent immigrants from Europe. Even in the Civil War, the Union laid such terrible waste to the South, with Union Army General Sherman declaring that war is hell, we need to make a brutal example of the South so they never will rise up again, right, and raise their hand against America. I suppose I should stick a little more with the immediate subject at hand. This person has a lot to say about false history of the Jewish people, about a lack of true cohesion, true ethnic cohesion among the ancient Jews. I learned something here. If this information is true, the ancient Hebrews did not speak the Hebrew of today. They spoke Aramaic and perhaps Quantrot, which I know was spoken by at least some of the Romans in Palestine, ancient Palestine. Unfortunately, a poorly directed and recalcitrant Palestinian community has been responsible for its decline and egregious fate. Referring to the West Bank's decline and fate. As sympathetic as the author may be with the Palestinians, he sees a fault with them there. Okay, well, I managed to get through both articles today. And, you know, no phone calls. I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm happy for the opportunity and privilege to do what I'm doing. I pay my dues every month for the privilege of being your host on Mideast Madness. We're still looking for a new location for a radio tower. We've got about 60 days to find and erect a tower on new land, as the current location is being foreclosed upon. Any help out there amongst anyone who knows of or has access to some high elevations out there, please get in touch. Go to freakradio.org. Click on links, the ones that work anyway. Call us up, pass your information on, send in donations, and I'll talk at you again next Monday, every Monday at 3 p.m. on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Thanks again.